I'd like to next welcome our distinguished speaker of the evening, Professor Charles Alexander. He was the winner of the 2003 Seymour Medal and the 2011 Henry Chadwick Award. And he is well known, I'm sure, by everyone in this room, as he wrote foundational books on Ty Cobb, John McGraw, Tris Speaker, and Rogers Hornsby. And I asked Professor Alexander to come and speak about his research methods and how he approached his work, how things have changed since he wrote his biography of Ty Cobb back in 1984, and to discuss the challenges of being a dead ball era baseball researcher. And he has graciously, after his remarks, has said that he would invite questions. So I'd like to welcome Professor Charles Alexander.
Thank you very much, John, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here and to speak to such a really good turnout. I was telling Rick Hune last night at dinner that on one occasion back before I retired as a professional historian, I was on a program for the Southern Historical Association, I think it was in Louisville, and the program drew exactly four people, three members of the panel and four members of the panel, actually three presenters and one chair. And on another occasion, in I believe it was Houston, at another historical convention, we had, I think, two people in the audience and one guy who stood at the back of the room at the door and refused to come in the whole time. So this is really a nice array of faces to look out over this evening. And John didn't really give me a title. He just said he wanted me to talk, you know, about some things about the dead ball era. And so I thought I'd come up with a really sexy title, Some Observations on the Dead Ball Era. I want to add my congratulations to Nathaniel and Chuck. Nathaniel has already preempted me about our background at Ohio University, except that I should add that in the baseball history course, it was at that time, I believe, one quarter. Later, it became just too much, and I divided it into two quarters, split it 1930. But in the one course that he took, back when it was just the one course, he did ace it, I should add that. And I should also add that probably he's too modest to mention it, but his book also won the 2014 Langham Prize for the best book in American legal and constitutional history. So it's been a good year for Nathaniel. And he also, I should also add that he is married to the daughter of a former professor at Ohio University. So there are a whole lot of connections here, as well as my connection to his colleague Mike Groh, retired from the history department at Ohio University, who was our Latin American historian in the department. So we go back a ways. He grew up in Athens, Ohio, of course, where, for the benefit of folks in Rio Linda, it's located, Ohio University is located there. And Ohio University can boast of two particular things with regard to baseball. Ohio University has produced a Hall of Famer in Mike Schmidt and a World Series winning manager in Bob Brindley. Now, I don't know of any other university that can claim those two accomplishments coming out of their baseball program. And I spent 37 years at Ohio University as a faculty member. And then I decided, well, had enough and quit fully in 2007. My assignment is to talk some about the dead ball era. Now, I want to do something maybe a little bit improper here. Dead ball era is a convenient term. And I'm not advocating that we call the period 1900-1919 and it's something else, but I would suggest really that it is a misnomer. All right? I've made half the room mad. Right off. But before I get to that, I want to talk about another misnomer, briefly. Why do we date the modern era in baseball history, quote unquote, from 1900? Did anything happen in baseball to justify that periodization apart from the emergence of the American League and the creation of the National Commission as baseball's governing body? I mean, did anything really happen in baseball from 1899 to 1900 or 1901 that would say, okay, this is pre-modern and that's post-modern? I don't get it. That periodization took hold somewhere along the line. I guess maybe with the rise of the American League and the promotion of the American League, okay, this is something new. We're in the modern era. But if you were Hannes Wagner, for example, would you have come to spring training in 1900 and say, hey, I'm playing in the modern era now? So I just don't think that has any legitimacy. I have no idea that it was, you know, the sportscasters and the sports writers and whatever will drop that designation, but, well, I just don't like it. Well, dead ball era. As to the designation dead ball era, I think we can say that nothing, and as far as I know, nothing, absolutely nothing, happened to the baseballs made by A.G. Sprawling and Brothers from 1899 to 1910. Or for that matter, going back to the 1870s at least, when A.G. Sprawling got the monopoly on making baseballs for the National League. It was baseball covered in horsehide, stitched, of course, yarn, and within the center of the yarn was a rubber center. That was the baseball. It was what it was in 1895 and what it was in 1905, and for that matter up to 1910. Same baseball. Now, of course, we all know, I think everybody in this room knows, that with the lengthening of the pitching distance in 1892 and some other changes, that there was a big boom in hitting that got underway, but had nothing to do with the ball itself. It was the dead ball. There were a few more home runs being hit because, you know, the pitchers were having a harder time of it, adjusting to the new distance. And of course, Hugh Duffy hit the 440. I think the latest figure is 442 on Hugh Duffy. And there was, you know, a whole lot of other big time hitting for a few years there before the pitchers adjusted to the 60 feet 6 inches. But, you know, nothing happened to the ball. It was dead. Or at least it was as dead as it had been, and it was as dead as it would continue to be. The cork-centered ball, as we know, was introduced in the National League late in the 1910 season, and it was used in both leagues beginning in 1911. Now, that produced a considerable spike in offensive output in 1911 and particularly 1912. 1911-1912. In 1911, Ty Cobb hit 420 with career highs also in runs and runs batted in, and 410 in 1912. Joe Jackson, of course, hit 408 in 1911 and lost the batting title. Sam Crawford hit 378 in 1911. Eddie Collins, 365, all career highs for those last three players that I mentioned. But the pitchers soon regained the upper hand, if they had ever lost it. I mean, after all, with all the hitting, additional hitting going on in 1912, Joe Wood won 34 games, Walter Johnson won 33 games, Ed Walsh 27, Eddie Plank 26, Bob Groom, sort of a forgotten star pitcher of that period, 24 games. Now, by 1917 or so, and no exact date, but about 1917, the game on the field was about back to where it had been in 1910. In other words, the pitchers were pretty much in control again. So, we refer to the dead ball era. It was, in general, an era of pitching domination. Why? Well, one factor undoubtedly was the advent of the pitcher's mound. Now, I have tried and tried to find out the origin of the pitcher's mound. We have rules regulating the height of the pitcher's mound at various periods in baseball history. There is absolutely nothing in the rules that establishes that there will be a pitcher's mound. Now, where did this come from? My theory is, at least, that after 1892, some groundskeepers or somebody had the idea of heaping some dirt in the middle of the infield, in which, of course, the rubber slab that was specified for the pitchers beginning in 1892 would be placed. And so the pitchers would gain some leverage in throwing downward toward the plate. But I just don't know where. Now, I'm sorry, but I have searched through Peter Morris's book, The Game of Inches, and he does not satisfy me on the question of the origin of the pitcher's mound. Now, if any of you have any information on that, I would hope that you would share it as well. But in any case, by 1900, 1901, the pitcher's mound was definitely in place. And that would be, I think, one of the factors that led to the increasing domination of pitchers after 1900. What else? Well, the foul strike rule, a very important factor here. Adopted by the National League in 1901, adopted by the American League 2 years later, Napoleon Lajoie was still hitting without the foul strike rule in 1901 when he hit, I think, the most recent statistical exactitude is 426 that he hit in 1901, of course, a 20th century high. Modern baseball high, I should say. The adoption of the foul strike rule in the American League in 1903 had the same effect that it had in the National League of depressing a batting. No longer could the batter just stand up and foul off ball after ball without it counting against him. The first two foul balls would count as strikes. Now, that gave a considerable advantage to the pitcher. Improve playing surfaces. One of the things that I came across in doing the book on the 1890-1891 baseball seasons, having to do with the Players League and so on, and looking at old lithographs of action on the field. Of course, no photography, but lithographs, so on, prints. And it did seem as if the base paths were no more than about 2 feet wide. That is the dirt part portion. It was truly a base path, in other words. Now, at what point do we get the curved out element in the infield? Behind the bases. From first, curving around like that to third. If you're trying to field the ball behind or in front of a 2 foot path, and the rest is grass, not very well maintained grass, then the flight of the ball or the path of the ball is going to be less predictable, it seems to me. So I don't know. This is another conjecture that I have. I'm full of conjectures as far as that goes. And of course, we have better gloves. It doesn't seem as if it would make much difference, but the addition of that leather strap between thumb and finger did apparently make a great deal of difference. It created a kind of pocket that gloves hadn't had before that time, and undoubtedly was a factor in improved fielding. Well, and fielding did improve dramatically. 1901, in the National League, the league fielding average was 947. In 1910, it was 959, an improvement of 18 points just in that decade. The American League, the improvement was even more dramatic, from 938 to 957. Now, I don't think there are any other there's any other 10-year period in which you get that kind of dramatic increase in fielding percentages. Something happened. I think, again, better fields, better gloves, has to do with better pitching as well. And of course, the dead ball era has a great deal to do with so-called trick pitches, the spit ball, the Emery ball, the this ball and that ball, the cut ball, the grass stained balls, tobacco stained balls, whatever, all, you know, which were kept in play, balls that were knocked around up in the stands and had to be returned to the field and were bruised and softened and so on. And so in the late innings, the ball wasn't as easy to see. It wasn't, if you hit it, it didn't go as far, and so on. It was unusual in that period for more than, say, three balls to be used during the course of the game. Now, the rule is that if the ball hits the dirt, the ground, it goes out of play, period. If it hits the ground in front of the catcher gets the umpire, throws it out. If it hits the grass in the outfield, by the time it's returned to the infield, throws it out. All of us, I think, probably can remember when a batter with a bouncer toward third base go off into foul territory, the third base coach would field it, throw it back to the pitcher, keep it in play. You don't see that anymore. But 100 years ago, balls were kept in play inning after inning after inning, as long as they were in any kind of condition at all. So all of these factors I've been mentioning here, all of that produced a corresponding decline in league batting averages from 1903. Why 1903 is my baseline? Because that was the year that both leagues were using the foul strike rule. From 1903 to 1910, a decline from 269 in the National League to 256, and from the American League from 255 to 243. And of course, corresponding declines in runs and earned run average. So those are some of the circumstances I just mentioned here that created what we call the dead ball era in that 19-year period. Well, as all of you know, and as has been mentioned here, I did once upon a time write a biography of Ty Cobb. It seemed like a long time ago now. In fact, it was 31 years ago that it was published. It was my first venture into baseball history. I like to remind people, maybe even Nathaniel can remember, when I did have a life before baseball history. I had published other books in more traditional lines of American history, and I really didn't think for a long time, or first 20 years or so of my academic career after I got my PhD, that I would ever get involved in baseball history. I was writing about the Eisenhower era, and I was writing about intellectuals, and I was writing about the Ku Klux Klan in Texas and in the Southwest in the 1920s. And okay, that was the way I was trained, more traditional history. And when I was in graduate school, nobody would thought about either writing or teaching baseball history. Not an academic person. Well, beginning with Ty Cobb, I got launched into baseball history. Well, it was a good way to start, because I found Ty Cobb to be an absolutely fascinating man. And as I had suggested really in the introduction to that book, I think Ty Cobb would have been very successful in a whole lot of lines of endeavor, not just baseball. He was a very intelligent man, very resourceful man, very insightful man about what he wanted to do with his life. Cobb did not change the way baseball was played, as I think we would all recognize, as Babe Ruth did, starting in 1919 and 1920. And what Cobb did was bring to its highest level of excellence and expertise the style of baseball that was being played when he reached the major leagues in 1905, at the age of 18. And I would suggest that as much as Ruth dominated the game in the 1920s, Cobb was the dominant player in the two decades we know as the dead ball era. Well, since Oxford University Press published my biography of Cobb in 1984, so much has been written about him that I can only scratch my head when I try to think of anything new, that is accurately new, that is to be said about him. We now have more biographies of Ty Cobb than we have biographies of President James K. Polk, who was arguably our most successful president. Now, I did not say the president with whose policies you can be most in agreement or that you can most admire, but in terms of the history of James K. Polk's 4 years as president, accomplishing the four things he came into office to accomplish, he was our most successful president. But not all that much written about. Not as many. And for that matter, I was looking at the most recent biography of Christy Mathewson, and we have, I think, more Mathewson biographies than Polk biographies, too. There's even a novel based on 1 year in Ty Cobb's life, written by Patrick Creevy and published in 2002. And I have the book, and before I left home, I was going to write down the publisher. It was rather a small publisher based in New York, not a vanity press by any means, a legitimate commercial publisher, but I just simply forgot to write down the name of it. It's not one that easily comes to mind. Well, Pat Creevy was up for promotion in the English department at Mississippi State, and I was asked to evaluate his novel for the benefit of his promotion committee. And I agreed with considerable skepticism. I mean, a novel about Ty Cobb. By that time, of course, that absolutely abominable movie, Cobb, had come out. And I thought, well, you know, this may be just as bad. But in fact, I found Pat's novel, while admittedly fictionalized, to be a really compelling rendering of the experiences of Ty Cobb as a boy, trying to make it in the big leagues under very trying circumstances. And so I reported to his committee. And I'm happy to say that Pat got his promotion as well. So, and I would recommend the novel to you. You could call it up on Amazon.com if you wish. It's a good piece of fiction. It gives you, I think, a pretty good sense of the tribulations of Ty Cobb. As a young player from the South, trying to make it in the big leagues on the Detroit Ball Club, made up mostly entirely of Northerners and largely Roman Catholics. Of course, Cobb was raised as a Baptist and so on. If you're at all interested, I think it's still in print and you could get it on Amazon.com. Well, two more Cobb biographies have come out this year, as I'm sure many of you know. The subtitle of Tim Hornbaker's book on Cobb proclaims it to be the definitive biography. Now, I don't want to get into business of comparisons. I just want to look at, you know, the term definitive. One of the things I learned in graduate study in history is that you don't ever call a work of history definitive because there's no such thing. Nothing ever absolutely defines a subject. And by the way, that's true not only in history, but it's also true in science. The science is not settled, no. It never is. Because it's in the nature of scientific and, well, intellectual inquiry in general, that it's ongoing process. It never ends. And so you, it's never definitive. Well, enough about that. Also recently published is Charles Learson's biography, which goes to great lengths. As I have not read it, but in the reviews I've read, that it does go to great lengths to rehabilitate the reputation of a man who in the last 20, 25 years has become basically a caricature, as given to us by people who refuse to take the trouble to scrutinize the large amount of Cobb mythology and folklore. And they go ahead and they blithely accept it, and they pass it along. Well, to be honest, that situation both saddens and angers me, because I think there's a great deal to be understood about Ty Cobb that people refuse to understand. Now, this is not a presentation on Ty Cobb, and I'm not going to, you know, go any further with that. It's just that I think it's very unfortunate that a very complicated man and a very great baseball player has been made into this caricature. As popularly understood today, I say popularly understood, Ty Cobb was a ranting racist. He was a mean-spirited man. Off the field, he was a vicious enemy of everybody on it. He was generally without friends and generally uninterested in having any friends. In short, he was an altogether despicable human being. That's the popular image, and I'm afraid we're stuck with it, despite the best efforts of some of us to cut through the caricature and get at the real man. And as I said, that situation both saddens and angers me, but I guess there's not a damn thing we can do about it at this point. Well, when I asked John McMurray what he had in mind for my presentation this evening, I'm not sure he had in mind any of what I've been talking about so far, but he suggested that I might talk a bit about doing research in the dead ball era. Well, of course, everybody from that time is dead, not only the ball, but the participants. And for that matter, though, the same is true of players of the 1920s, and the great majority played before 1940 or so. So what are we going to do? You know, we can't talk to these people. A certain amount of correspondence and other kinds of primary materials, the kind of stuff that historians really lust after, is available. The Cobb collection at the National Baseball Library, for example, is fairly extensive. It's one of the largest, in fact, of an individual player at Cooperstown. Still, we mostly have to rely on records and contemporary coverage in daily newspapers, the weekly Sport Reporting News and Sporting Life, and, you know, to some extent, magazines. Everybody in this room, moreover, recognizes the invaluable roof of work of the late Lawrence Ritter in collecting interviews of players from the early 20th century before they left us. And this book award that Daniel and Nathaniel and Chuck are sharing this evening is rightly named for that pioneer in baseball oral history. John McMurray also raised the matter of how one goes about writing dialogue when little of it is preserved. Well, I don't write dialogue. And frankly, for all the value of, for example, Fred Leeds and others' team histories in the old Putnam series, it just jars my sensibilities to read the invented dialogue that the authors of those books put into people's mouths. Fiction writers are free to invent dialogue. People trying to write serious history should do that. So what I look for, especially, is quotable material from players, managers, owners, sports writers, whoever. Quotable material that can be used to illustrate and enliven and punctuate the narrative. On a few occasions, I quoted conversations, but only as a conversation has been reported by a participant or eyewitness. For example, I included one bit of dialogue in my 2011 book, Turbulent Seasons. It was a conversation between A.G. Spaulding and John Montgomery Ward in December 1890, in the aftermath of the collapse of the Players League. But that conversation was reported by Tim Murnane, of the Boston Globe who arranged the meeting between Spalding and Ward at the Manhattan Club and sat in on the meeting. So, I mean, I think it's fine to report, include dialogue, if you have that kind of person who actually witnessed the dialogue taking place. Okay. I want to end what may have seemed like a series of disorganized and random remarks with the tale of a lost and precious primary source. In 1982, on my first trip to Cooperstown to do research on Cobb, I was going through a thick folder of Cobb materials when Tom Redding, the assistant to the National Baseball Library archivist at that time, Cliff Kackline, asked me if I wanted to listen to a tape-recorded interview with Cobb. Well, of course I said yes. Cliff Kackline himself said he didn't know that there was such a thing in the library. But Tom Redding shortly produced the tape spindles and hooked them up in one old-fashioned tape recorder. So for about 2 hours I listened to Cobb. And he was sitting in his apartment in Cordelia, Georgia, early in 1958, and being interviewed by the Atlanta correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Now, this was about 3.5 years before he died. Cobb reminisced in considerable detail about his boyhood, his careers both in baseball and business, his life in general. It was a fascinating experience. And of course, I used quite a lot of what I learned in those tapes from my book. Well, a few years later, when I was back at the National Baseball Library doing research for my John McGraw biography, I mentioned the Cobb interview tapes to Tom Heitz, who had succeeded Kackline as the archivist. Tom was dumbfounded to hear about it. Even while I was there, Tom instituted a search for the tapes, but they never turned up. I was later told that even the FBI had brought in. They've been brought in.
The FBI called you.
The FBI, did he call?
They made a phone call.
Yeah, I forgot.
Yes.
An FBI agent called me, asked me what I knew about these tapes. I have no idea what happened to them. I've told a number of people, including the FBI agent, over the years, have contacted me about where they could possibly be. And in some instances, people have raised doubts with me that I actually heard them. Yeah, I actually did hear them. I sat there and listened to them. Well, I don't know. I'm sure the National Baseball Library archives are managed more systematically and efficiently now than it was the case 30 years ago. But it's, of course, far too late where the Cobb tapes are concerned. So, on that unhappy note, I'll conclude. I've enjoyed sharing some thoughts with you on the dead ball era. My congratulations again to Nathaniel and Chuck. Thank you very much.